Chapter 18. Responsibility First. In 1893, the historian Frederick Turner wrote a celebrated essay about the importance of the frontier to how Americans think about freedom. On the frontier, he noted, families and communities were mostly on their own, and thus in a different cultural, economic, and political environment than either New England or the South. Already, the American Revolution had created a culture whereby individual liberty was sometimes confused with absence of all effective government, noted Turner. The experience of living on the Western frontier produces antipathy to control, and particularly to any direct control. No state embodies the frontier more than California. What happened during the 1960s in the counterculture's attempt to escape traditional obligations was an extension, not rejection, of the American frontier notion of freedom as the absence rather than presence of strong ties. To some extent, the frontier always romanticized the disaffiliated man, from the gold miner to the entrepreneur to the hobo. But there was always also a civic spirit, a dream of creating a better society together, and an appreciation of the norm of reciprocity, until the 1960s when the progressive left sought to replace the principle of gratitude for charity with an attitude of entitlement. It is thus not just in the name of compassion that Californians allow our most vulnerable fellow humans to live on the street. It is also in the name of liberty. San Francisco embodies an extreme version of the American dream. Americans come from all over the country, as do immigrants from all over the world, to San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle. These cities' liberal coastal nature and their distance from the established rules and norms of the East Coast establishment encouraged a bohemian libertarian culture. I think it's the left combined with libertarianism around substances, said Keith Humphreys, that is actually the mix that makes it really hard to manage these problems. The West is far more libertarian about lots of things. Out West, it's more do whatever you want, and no one has a right to interfere with your view. Sometimes that is terrific. We're the home of gay rights, but it doesn't work well for addiction. The pursuit of allegedly individual freedom ends up ultimately killing the person and does enormous damage to everybody else. That's the basis of a lot of intervention by friends and family of addicts. But it's been politically nullified out in the American West. And that's why we don't have Portuguese outcomes. We commonly assume that left and right are opposites. Yet the libertarian right and the progressive left have been in a tacit alliance against greater government action on addiction and mental illness for at least 50 years. True, most of the right simply opposed stronger public action on mental illness out of discomfort with psychology and government spending on social services. But the power of libertarian ideas and institutions within the Republican coalition, along with broader confusion about psychiatry and drugs, meant that conservatives largely went along with progressive demands to shut down psychiatric hospitals, replace contingency management with housing first, and underinvest in addiction treatment and recovery. In 2012, the novelist Kurt Anderson made a similar observation. What has happened politically, economically, culturally, and socially since the sea change of the late 60s isn't contradictory or incongruous, he wrote. It's all of a piece. For hippies and bohemians, as for business people and investors, extreme individualism has been triumphant. Do your own thing is not so different than every man for himself. Some people have told me that they thought San Francisco's safe sleeping sites looked like a natural disaster. But with city-funded social workers providing services to the people in tents, it looked to me more like a medical experiment, albeit one that no board of ethics would ever permit. At the sites, the city isn't providing drug treatment. It's providing easy access to drugs. That includes, as we have seen, cash in the form of welfare payments with which to purchase drugs, and the equipment with which to inject them. While San Francisco's approach to homelessness can be fairly described as pathological altruism, it would be unfair to call it Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which is when a parent deliberately makes their child sick so they can feel important. Many of the drug-addicted and mentally ill homeless are, in fact, sick, and most progressives have good intentions. But it is not unfair to point out that the city's approach of playing the rescuer is resulting in worsening addiction and rising overdose deaths. Nor is it unfair to point out that we limit people's potential for freedom by labeling them victims and centering their trauma, rather than viewing victimization as an opportunity for heroism. Nor is it unfair to point out, as I have attempted to do by describing the history, that San Francisco's political, business, and cultural leaders should all know better by now. People suffering addiction and living on the street are ill. To mix them up in speech and policy with people who are merely poor is deceptive. Leading scholars have for 30 years denounced the conflation of the merely poor with disaffiliated addicts. Yet progressive advocates for the homeless continue to engage in the same sleight of hand by using the single term homeless, tricking journalists, policymakers, and the public into mixing together groups of people who require different kinds of help. Progressives justify their discourse in the name of preventing dehumanization, but the effect has been the opposite. In defending the humanity of addicts, progressives ended up defending the inhumane conditions of street addiction. The morality of victimology contains a version of all six values identified in moral foundations theory. The problem is that those values are oriented around those defined as victims in a particular context, to the exclusion of everyone else. But not even the most devoted homeless activists could do whatever drug-addicted homeless people demand of them. The demand that we give victims special political authority is thus really a demand to give special political authority to those who claim to represent the supposed victims, namely homelessness advocates. The power of victimology lies in its moralizing discourse more than in any single set of laws. I was struck in my research that progressive civil society actors like Jennifer Friedenbach, Margot Cushell, and Sam Semberis have had a far greater impact on public policy and the reality on the streets than countless progressive politicians. It is notable that while Friedenbach, Cushell, and Semberis are the most influential individuals in shaping homeless policy in San Francisco and Los Angeles, they are also the least accountable. As the problem has worsened, their cultural and political power has grown, while voters understandably blame their local elected leaders for the crisis. Progressive advocates and policymakers alike blame the drug war, mass incarceration, and drug prohibition for the addiction and overdose crisis, even though the crisis resulted from liberalized attitudes and drug laws, first toward pharmaceutical opioids and then toward all drugs. This view is, on the one hand, a defensive and ideological reaction, but it is also an abdication of responsibility. One of my motivations in writing this book was to understand how anarchism, or what is sometimes called left libertarianism, gained so much power in progressive West Coast cities. I believe part of the answer lies in its lack of accountability, which is itself a kind of power. Anarchists can cheerlead disruptive and even violent actions, and then evade responsibility when things go wrong. It is notable that America's most influential anarchist, Noam Chomsky, selects a few points in history. A 10-month period in Spain in 1936, when large regions of the country were governed autonomously and locally, and the early kibbutzim in Palestine before the creation of the State of Israel, when Jews, Muslims, and atheists all supposedly lived together in harmony, as models of anarchist rule. Are those episodes really models for how to govern a large city, state, or nation today? Of course they aren't. But naming such episodes as the anarchist ideal allows Chomsky to reject responsibility for anarchist actions that go terribly wrong, such as in the occupied zones in Seattle and Minneapolis. While we should hold our elected officials responsible, we must also ask hard questions of the intellectual architects of their policies, and of the citizens, donors, and voters who empower them. What kind of a civilization leaves its most vulnerable people to use deadly substances and die on the streets? What kind of city regulates ice cream stores more strictly than drug dealers who kill 713 of its citizens in a single year? What kind of people moralize about their superior treatment of the poor, people of color, and addicts, while enabling and subsidizing the conditions of their death? Over a decade ago, Jonathan Haidt warned that progressives needed to have a broader moral vision. They needed to value more things. Wrote Haidt, "Self-control over self-expression, duty over rights, and loyalty to one's groups over concerns for out-group are values necessary to the functioning of civilization. Such values," Haidt warned, "cannot be supported by the care and fairness foundations alone. You have to build on the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations as well. My research for San Francisco leads me to agree and build on Haidt's argument by adding that how we value matters as much as what we value. And so it is to reconstructing a new moral foundation, one capable of uniting moderate conservatives and progressives, that we can now turn. Cities are sacred, and thus there must be rules for behavior in them. It is simply not okay to allow people to sleep on sidewalks, in parks, and on the sides of highways. Nor is it okay for people to sit on the sidewalk and shout threats and profanity at people who walk by, nor for people to defecate in front of retail offices and stores. If restaurants and other businesses want to serve their customers at tables and chairs on sidewalks, they must apply for special permits. That was still the case even during the pandemic. People must not be exempted from this because we feel sorry for them and label them victims. When we allow for the chronic violation of laws and social norms, we erode the foundation of our cities and civilization. The city is sacred because it is, or can be, the place of highest human possibility, flourish, and freedom. The public's horror at open-air drug use and defecation stems from a justified disgust at the violation and contamination of shared public and common spaces. Homeless encampments damage the social fabric that makes cities possible. The same goes for criminal justice. Abuses by the police undermine the public's trust in government, and thus loyalty to the city, state, and nation, which contributes to collective safety and public order. And high rates of homicide destroy the fabric of cities and communities. Coastal progressive cities have shown us that we cannot effectively address past racial injustices without also addressing homicides in our cities, or we will worsen the wrongs we seek to rectify. All Americans of all political ideologies, religions, social classes, and races have an interest in focusing our attention, finally, on our nation's tragically high homicide rates. Stigmatizing hard drug use and breaking up the open-air drug markets will not end drug dealing, but it will significantly reduce the violence associated with drugs by moving the drug trade indoors, and thus dispersing it. Doing so may have the added benefit of increasing costs for dealers and users. The American people are capable of distinguishing between stigmatizing fentanyl use without stigmatizing the sick person who is using fentanyl. The person requires our compassion, but the behavior requires our condemnation. We need a new pro-human, pro-civilization, and pro-cities morality. Freedom is essential, but without order it can't exist in cities. If we are not safe, if our cities are not walkable, then we don't have a civilization. In some ways, the new morality may seem like a return to an older Enlightenment morality. But the morality we need would define liberty more around affiliation than disaffiliation, and value the freedom that comes from taking responsibility more than the freedom to reject it. Social norms are always individual and social. Most are never enforced because nobody wants to feel the social embarrassment of being caught not picking up after their dog. One of the most important discoveries of sociologists in the late 20th century, as they sought to understand rising crime rates, was that most people obey the law not because they are afraid of being caught violating it, but because they believe in the law and that it's being administered fairly. The fact that a significant number of elected progressive Democrats, including district attorneys and supervisors in Los Angeles, Seattle, and San Francisco, have in recent years openly called for enforcing the law differently according to race and class, and have started doing so, is a disturbing threat both to public order and to the principle of equal justice under the law. In 2018, Patrick Collison, the CEO and co-founder of Stripe, an internet financial services firm, published an essay that described why he opposed Proposition C, the initiative written by Jennifer Friedenbach and championed by Salesforce's Mark Benioff. Stripe is highly motivated to help solve homelessness, he wrote. We're happy to pay higher taxes as part of doing so, a position we've made clear from the start. Stripe employees and Stripe itself have long worked to help housing-related causes and homeless service providers. But, he added, if homelessness was just a question of money, this issue would already be solved. Collison had run the numbers. While cities report inconsistently, San Francisco currently spends around $430 per city resident per year on services and programs for the homeless, compared to $260 in New York and $110 in Los Angeles. Yet the problem in our city is worse. He called for systemic changes and effective accountability. Progressives, including Benioff, criticized Collison sharply, but he found an unlikely ally in Riva Tez, a Britain-born San Francisco-based tech entrepreneur who had been homeless as a girl. Tez's mother suffered schizophrenia, and they both squatted illegally and lived in a shelter. Living in a homeless shelter really shaped me, said Riva. I think that experience as a child made me much more sympathetic to those situations, because I can see my mother in all of them. But Tez does not share the views of progressive homelessness advocates. I had a friend who went to work in an NGO, Tez said. She is the most high-integrity person I know. After a year, she had completely changed all her views. She said she never realized how much of an industry poverty was. The Proposition C campaign upset Tez. They manipulated the narrative to be, "Are you for or against the homeless?" she said. If you said you're against Prop C, people would say, "You hate the homeless." I'm like, there are better things to do to help the homeless, because it doesn't seem like the problem in San Francisco is that the homeless service providers don't have enough money. It seems like we don't have enough accountability. Collison's decision could not have been easy. Patrick put himself on the line because he was going against the homeless narrative, said Riva. I mean, they had protests outside the Stripe offices. There was bravery in that, said a writer for a San Francisco venture capital firm, Michael Solana. There is a broader problem in our culture right now where people don't feel comfortable to speak. The city was a culture of new things, but then politically, it became hostile to new things, from new housing to new technologies. Chris Rufo similarly pointed to the need to confront taboos. The chief of psychiatry in a public hospital system in one of the largest California cities told me, "I know for a fact, and all of my colleagues know, that what we actually need to deal with the problem in the biggest cities in California is long-term residential secure psychiatric care. But I can't say that publicly because I would be disemboweled by the activist left. My job would be in jeopardy. My reputation would be in jeopardy. My whole life would get turned upside down for even broaching the subject of expanding secure mental health facilities and compulsory mental health treatment." And I said, "So what's the solution?" And this person said, "We muddle through." Stanford's Keith Humphreys described something similar. "The mayors of cities call me and they'll agree privately. Yeah, we can't just have a motto where you use as much hard drugs as you want, wherever you want, and nothing bad ever happens to you." And I say, "Okay, here's some ways to change." "Nope. Whoa, wait. Nope, nope. No pressure allowed, no accountability allowed." "When you dealt with the heroin epidemic in the 80s and 90s, I asked René Jaegerius in Amsterdam, "were there activists who said that you should not do anything? That you should let people be addicts?" "Helping, helping," said René. "We should help them. Today we have policing forums. But that was not the case in the beginning of the epidemic. Then we just had to help the poor bastards." "Did the conservative parties say, 'No, you have to have law enforcement?'" I asked. "The people in the politics are more to the right today than in the 80s, he said. "We had very large left-wing political parties then. Most of them formed the government. Now Dilan's party, which is a little right of the middle, is the ruling party, but they were small in the 80s. Could a similar change occur on the progressive West Coast?" After I told Rufo that I had found openness among some progressives to greater mandatory treatment of the seriously mentally ill, he said, "I think there probably is openness among the center-left. But the problem, too, is that the real power holders in these conversations are the activist organizations. You have disability rights groups, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the umbrella of individual rights and rights protection groups for people who are mentally ill and people who are addicted. And they have manipulated the legal system into codifying their preferences and basically bully and bowl over any public officials that would cross their path for even a moderate compromise. Part of the reason I have focused on Amsterdam as a potential model is precisely because it is so liberal. It proves that cities with very progressive attitudes towards sex and drugs are not doomed to skyrocketing overdose deaths, open drug scenes, and homeless encampments. Gay and lesbian people were out in Amsterdam in the 1920s, 40 years before they were in the Castro, Harvey Milk's neighborhood in San Francisco. It was one of the first developed nations to decriminalize marijuana and allow its relatively open use. Prostitution is legal and regulated. And yet the Dutch have managed to maintain the safety and sanctity of the city and protect human dignity. Amsterdam is one of the few large cities in the world where one is relatively safe walking around in almost every neighborhood, even in the middle of the night. Its treatment of people suffering from mental illness and addiction is world class. And it even allows for some experimentation with psychedelic drugs, which hold significant therapeutic potential. Conservative thinkers whom I interviewed all said they favored taxpayer support for housing the people who genuinely need it. Good people who really care about mental health reform are generally supportive of the idea that seriously mentally ill people are disabled, said Stephen Ide. If you're really schizophrenic, if you are mentally disabled, you probably will need the government to give you housing for the rest of your life. You'll need health care. You'll need an income source. Rising overdose deaths, the vacuum of leadership and vision, and the sheer disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic made some people wonder if the crisis had created a real opportunity for change on the West Coast. When I asked her what she thought was possible, given how many reform-minded tech workers had left San Francisco, Reva said. It does feel like the end of an era, and makes me sad. At the same time, she said, there's a lot of people trying to think, like, how do we fix this? In normal times, we pay our taxes and expect that, in return, police will prevent and investigate crimes, sidewalks and streets will be as clean and clear as possible, and our children can expect from their schools a decent education. When Bill Maher says, I don't know what I'm getting for my super high taxes, he's saying something important. Nobody knows what the exchange between rights and responsibilities is, as taxpayers and as citizens. It is time to spell out what we should expect for our super high taxes. California's state auditor and the legislative analyst's office imply that homelessness can be solved through coordination. But everybody knows that when you want to get something done, you need a hierarchy, with a clear line of command, and with leaders at the top who have both authority and accountability. What California needs is a new, single, and powerful state agency. Let's call it CalPSYCH. It would be built as a separate institution from existing institutions, including state and county health departments and health providers. CalPSYCH would efficiently and humanely treat the seriously mentally ill and addicts, while providing housing to the homeless on a contingency-based system. CalPSYCH's CEO would be best in class and report directly to the governor. It's only in this way that the voters can hold the governor accountable for the crisis on the streets. CalPSYCH would have significant buying power, be attractive to employees, and be able to move clients to where they need to be. It would be able to purchase psychiatric beds, board and care facilities, and treatment facilities from across the state. And it would be able to offer the mentally ill and those suffering substance abuse disorders drug and psychiatric treatment somewhere other than in an open-air drug scene. CalPSYCH would start in one city, learn rapidly, and then grow, ultimately taking over from the counties. We must learn from the mistakes of the past. We shut down state mental hospitals before we had created the alternative. CalPSYCH would be scaled up over time, replacing various institutions that are currently doomed to failure. Legislation would be required to reallocate resources currently being wasted through the Mental Health Services Act. California must apply for the Medicaid waiver to expand psychiatric beds. CalPSYCH would attract an A-list workforce, including assertive social workers with a whatever-it-takes mandate. CalPSYCH would do as much as legally, ethically, and practically possible to establish voluntary drug treatment and psychiatric care, and would also work with the courts and law enforcement to enforce involuntary care through assisted outpatient treatment and conservatorship. The low-hanging fruit, according to Renee, is getting 20-something-year-old opioid addicts off the street and into medically assisted treatment programs, since we have good substitutes for opioids in the form of Suboxone and methadone. The higher-hanging fruit is helping service-resistant people suffering from serious mental illness. All of CalPSYCH's involuntary treatment programs would work with California's criminal justice system to protect individual rights, expand alternatives to jail, and get people the care they need. California is overdue for a turn toward pragmatism and moderation when it comes to these issues. Californians do not want to return to mass incarceration, nor to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. At the same time, Californians want and deserve public order, which has broken down. Assisted outpatient treatment and conservatorship protect individual rights through the courts and allow non-jail and non-prison alternatives focused on psychiatric care. The ACLU has, in the past, done much good to protect rights, but they have taken an extreme position against conservatorship, such that they are actively contributing to the current crisis. Surveys find voters support a balanced carrot-and-stick approach. 89% of voters support greater involuntary commitment of homeless individuals with severe mental illness and behavioral issues. While voters generally prefer local solutions, noted a pollster, they are so frustrated with lack of action, the Californians now put responsibility for solving the homelessness problem on state officials over local officials, by a 62-38% margin. And while some counties may resist CalPsych, many others recognize that they cannot solve the problem. They may be happy to let go of the responsibility of caring for the chronic homeless, so long as they are reassured that they will not lose funding or control over county programs for those with milder mental illness such as depression, which are best handled at the county level. Assisted outpatient treatment, which treats the mentally ill outside of hospitals, would play a central role. Treatment in the community would be preferred over hospitals, so no one is treated in a hospital if they don't have to be. However, sometimes severely mentally ill individuals need to be stabilized or cared for with treatments provided only by hospitals. We need to increase the number of mental health beds in hospitals, whether public or private, to the California Hospital Association standard of 50 beds per 100,000 people. We should also expand conservatorship so loved ones can better care for their severely mentally ill kin. CalPsych would also fight drug addiction through expanded drug treatment. The key time to offer drug treatment to a person suffering from addiction is when they are revived from the brink of death with Narcan. It is an existential moment par excellence. You have nearly died by smoking too much fentanyl and were saved by one of your fellow Americans. The CalPsych worker who revives you would be able to offer you drug treatment, available immediately, where you will have the opportunity to detox and get therapy. CalPsych would help lengthen court-ordered drug treatment and provide enough resources so that recovering addicts aren't forced to leave rehab right when their cravings peak. Sobering centers would also be provided to individuals still struggling with addiction. CalPsych would get homeless people off the streets. For the one-third of the homeless who have severe mental illness, CalPsych compels treatment and supervised care. CalPsych would intervene at two different moments in the homeless addict's life, either when he is revived from overdose, or after he is caught repeatedly committing nuisance crimes, like public defecation, shoplifting, or public intoxication. In the latter case, drug treatment will be offered as an alternative to jail. In both instances, CalPsych would offer opportunities to learn to work and build a new life. CalPsych would help homeless drug addicts and mentally ill individuals stay healthy and housed by offering a variety of housing on a contingency basis. Through CalPsych, California would dramatically increase the types of shelter and housing available to the homeless. Every homeless person should have access to shelter every night and must use it. Purchasing residential homes and converting the Project Roomkey hotels into abstinence contingent hotels would be a key first step. The governor could issue state of emergency declarations to acquire shelters and housing. CalPsych caseworkers would have a whatever-it-takes mandate to get people off the street. They would track their clients when they go into a hospital, jail, or shelter. Caseworkers would also know if their client relapsed or stopped taking medication. Greater court-ordered supervision would allow caseworkers to impose the order and structure missing from the chaotic lives of the mentally ill, so they can get the psychiatric and therapeutic help they need to eventually live more independently. CalPsych would have mobile units capable of performing on-the-spot psychiatric evaluations, enrollment in programs, and the replacement of medical identification cards, which homeless drug users tend to lose. CalPsych would work with law enforcement to break up the open drug scenes in the Tenderloin, Skid Row, and the Blade, reimpose consequences for petty crimes through drug courts and mental illness courts, and redevelop rundown infrastructure, allowing for a larger, more diverse, and more functional community. There are models of effective and humane responses to the mentally ill and street addicts in the United States. Arizona and Texas have police officers trained to handle mental health calls. They track down people who have violated court orders for treatment. They check in on people. They often have social workers with them. Crucially, their status allows them to handle people who might be in a violent, psychotic state, which social workers are usually not equipped to handle. Positive relationships between healthcare providers and police are possible. And there are even the seeds of Cal Psych in pragmatically minded health professionals in California. LA street doctor Susan Partovi spoke optimistically about the Los Angeles Police Department's head of mental evaluation. "He does not come off as a cop at all," she said. "Most compassionate guy I've ever met. Doesn't have that arrogance. Really cares about this population." He said, "I want my police to know who's gravely disabled and a danger to self." Susan and the officer created a checklist for police officers to use when interacting with homeless people in psychotic states. Together, they are seeking to apply legal conservatorship to mentally ill homeless. Let's see if they're willing to start taking medications on the streets. The money for Cal Psych could come from three sources: California's failed Mental Health Services Act, Proposition 63, Medicaid, and, over time, the city and county funding currently being allocated to unaccountable nonprofit service providers. "Braid your money," said John Snook. "Get your Prop 63 money, get your federal housing funds, your Housing First funding, everything together. Cal Psych would have then the authority." That's where it breaks down in California. All of these random nonprofit service providers that are letting things fall through the cracks. Opposition to Cal Psych may come from some existing mental health care providers. But what's going for the idea is the spectacular failure of the current system. When there are quiet conversations, a lot of people are saying it doesn't make a ton of sense for every single county in the Bay Area to be doing something different, said Snook. Somebody walks across an imaginary border, and suddenly you don't have any ability to engage them in a program. I think a lot of people recognize that. Opposition may also come from some libertarians and conservatives, but Cal Psych would not socialize a private market, and thus should not arouse their fears. The government already treats the mentally ill, but in prisons instead of hospitals and outpatient centers. Services for the severely mentally ill and drug addicted are not a market for anyone except the very wealthy, who can afford private rehabilitation centers like the one that dispenses tough love in Malibu, which could continue to operate independently of Cal Psych's mandate to treat the severely mentally ill homeless. Some may hesitate to support centralizing government mental health services, but doing so would enable efficiencies, cut government waste, and reverse the mass incarceration of the severely mentally ill, which are outcomes that should be persuasive to people with either libertarian or progressive leanings. As such, Cal Psych and the creation of universal psychiatric care for the severely mentally ill homeless could represent a moral, human, and technological frontier for California. After the closing of the formal frontier, California pioneered frontiers of space exploration, medicine, information and communications technology, and alternative medicines, including psychedelics, which show promise for many, from cancer patients to rape victims. Imagine the sense of pride Californians could feel for Cal Psych. After vacationing in Italy, Dr. Thomas Insel said, "I jumped in a cab to go to the airport. The cab driver was showing me all the sights when, at one point, he turned to me and said, 'We have the best mental health care in the world here.' And I thought, that's pretty weird. I've never had a cab driver in California say that to me. But that was a part of who they are. There's tremendous pride around that." Progressives say they want livable, walkable cities, but by allowing the continued operation of open-air drug scenes, They are making cities unlivable and unwalkable, as well as inhumane. No psychologist or psychiatrist in America believes meth and fentanyl are appropriate medicines for schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or depression. And yet taxpayers in the San Francisco Bay Area, Seattle, and Los Angeles are, in effect, subsidizing their use and abuse by giving away free hotel rooms, cash, food, and much else. Too often, progressive idealism creates greater loyalty to a highly romanticized view, one that allowed progressives to justify defunding and shutting down core institutions, including psychiatric hospitals, police stations, and homeless shelters. We have these very high ideals about making criminal justice problems public health problems, San Francisco supervisor Raphael Mandelman acknowledged. We haven't begun to figure out how to organize and operationalize a public health structure that would allow public health to assume responsibility for that kind of transformation. We rip down an ugly, problematic system that in some ways worked and in a lot of ways didn't, and fail to replace it with anything adequate to managing the challenge. And now it feels like we're doing something similar with criminal justice. Like Mandelman, other elected officials are beginning to stand up to the more ideological advocates of harm reduction and housing first, and advocating the expansion of temporary shelters. It's estimated that it will take till 2035 or 2040 to build enough permanent housing, Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg said to Housing First advocate Margot Cushell at a televised event in 2019. The only question I'm asking is, what do we do in the meantime? But many progressive advocates, more powerful than ever, had become more dogmatic. The founder of Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman, turned out to be a relative moderate in comparison to his successor. They have really changed since he's left, said Humphreys. I knew Ethan and a lot of the people there. There's been quite a turnover, and the viewpoint is much more towards the San Francisco model. There were more people there than who at least were a little more grounded in evidence than ideology than is the case now. The political establishment in California and progressive West Coast cities has plainly failed, but voters are still not being offered a genuine alternative to status quo policies. Cal Psych offers voters an alternative between lawlessness and mass incarceration, and between chronic homelessness and chronic institutionalization. A new political vision, agenda, and leadership are needed to overcome the divisions and chaos. The central conservative truth is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society, noted the late Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. The central liberal truth is that politics can change a culture and save itself from itself. California residents, as previously noted, appear ready for the state to take over where counties have failed. And when the context broadens from San Francisco to California, more seems possible. I actually think there's hope for the state of California, said Michael Solana. There are a lot of people who are cognizant of the state government's failures and want to see meaningful change, said Stephen Ide. Revolutions in social policy do happen sometimes, and it's conceivable that something like that could happen with homelessness.